This is for sure. They were featuring a recent interview Terry did. You want to put that in three? Tape three instead of... From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, filling in for Terry Gross, who's attending the annual Public Radio Conference. When Pete Hamill was starting out as a big city reporter in the early 1960s, drinking with the boys was part of the territory. But he gave up the bottle 20 years ago, and he hasn't had a drink since. On today's Fresh Air, Pete Hamill tells us about the years he led the drinking life. It's the subject of his recent memoir. Also today, Shirley Taylor Hayslip. She's black, but her mother's side of the family was very light-skinned. In fact, many of her relatives passed for white. Hayslip's new memoir is about tracking down the part of her family that disappeared into the white world. And commentator Maureen Corrigan has a review of The Silent Woman, Janet Malcolm's book on the many biographers of Sylvia Plath. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says he doesn't want to be considered as a candidate for the Supreme Court. Justice Harry Blackmun is retiring, and Mitchell had been widely considered as the leading candidate to succeed him. The Maine Democrat says President Clinton did want to nominate him.
Although it would be an honor to be considered for the court, I believe I can best serve by concentrating this year on health care reform and the rest of the president's agenda for change, including crime control legislation, welfare reform, campaign finance reform, the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, and other measures. It is an agenda which I strongly support.
Mitchell is a 60-year-old Democrat from Maine. He's also reported to be a top candidate for the commissioner of Major League Baseball. Mitchell says he's not been offered the job, but will consider that if it is. President Clinton is warning the Bosnian Serbs he won't rule out new and broader airstrikes against them if they attack safe havens in Bosnia. U.S. warplanes have participated in two NATO airstrikes against Serbs this week. The Serbs have been shelling Garajda. The president says the NATO planes are at the disposal of the U.N. commander, and he could use them elsewhere in Bosnia. A French relief group says 11 of its workers are being held hostage by Serbian forces outside Sarajevo. The French government has appealed for their release. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French aid organization Première Urgence, First Urgency, said 11 of its aid workers, including a woman, were arrested by Serb forces outside Sarajevo on Friday while they were on their way to the Bosnian capital with a convoy carrying about 50 tons of food. A spokesman for the group, Pierre Salashov, says he believes they were arrested because they refused to give half of the food to the Serbs. The Serbs have accused the aid workers of trying to smuggle ammunition into Sarajevo and plan to put them on trial. Belgrade TV broadcast a film showing there were crates of heavy machine gun ammunition in the convoy. Salashov says they were framed. French government has appealed to the Bosnian Serbs to release them. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Pulitzer Prizes in Journalism and the Arts have been announced. The New York Times has won 3 prizes for its coverage of the World Trade Center bombing, the Midwest flooding last summer, and a photography award. The Dallas Morning News won the International Reporting Prize for an exam of violence against women around the world. The National Reporting Prize goes to Albuquerque Tribune reporter Eileen Welsom. She broke the story about Americans being unknowingly used in government radiation experiments nearly 50 years ago. The Pulitzer Prize for Drama goes to Edward Albee for his play 3 Tall Women. It's his 3rd such award. On Wall Street, the Dow is down a fraction at 3,687. This is NPR. Japan's ruling coalition is struggling to choose a new prime minister. Premier Morihiro Hosokawa is stepping down. Speculation is growing that he will be succeeded by the foreign minister, Tsutsumi Hata. Hata also works as Japan's deputy prime minister, but he is supposed to leave tomorrow for world trade talks in Morocco. Hata has not thrown his hat into the ring formally, but he is a former finance minister and is seen as a good choice to boost the sagging Japanese economy. Kigali, Rwanda's capital, is in shambles. Loud explosions and heavy guns can be heard round the clock. Bodies are strewn in the streets. The rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front is advancing on the capital. The BBC's Mark Doyle is in the city, traveling with French troops. He says the Rwandan government has fled.
Workers at the hotel where the fledgling government was staying said ministers had left. It seems likely that they have fled the rebel advance, but it is possible that they have regrouped elsewhere. Heavy fighting continued through the middle of the day, with the sound of mortars and automatic gunfire echoing around the hills and valleys of Kigali. The rebels say they are a few kilometers from the capital and have vowed to take it, to, in their words, restore order. Tens of thousands of Rwandans are fleeing south towards neighboring Burundi as the rebels approach from the north. Most are on foot. An eyewitness said he saw a column of people 5 kilometers long. Other rich Rwandans are driving south in Mercedes saloons with armed escorts in civilian clothes.
Mark Doyle reporting. Los Angeles commuters can now drive on the Santa Monica Freeway. The roadway is known as the nation's busiest. It was closed for damage repairs after the January earthquake. The opening also comes 2.5 months ahead of schedule. California Governor Pete Wilson says the speed shows what can happen when red tape is cut. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we feature a recent interview Terry did with journalist Pete Hamill. Hamill once fit the image of the hard-drinking journalist, hanging out in bars, letting off steam with the other reporters, and coaxing information out of neighborhood sources. But he hasn't had a drink in over 20 years. His recent memoir, A Drinking Life, is about the culture of drink he was once a part of and why he gave it up. Pete Hamill began his writing career in 1960 as a reporter for the New York Post. The paper's reputation was then based on its local reporting and liberal columnists. Hamill later became one of the paper's most popular columnists. The Post is now famous for its tabloid headlines and its changes of ownership. During one of those ownership changes, Hamill was hired, then fired, as editor-in-chief. But he kept putting the paper together anyway. Now he has no affiliation with the Post. Terry asked Pete Hamill if he thinks of himself as having helped create the myth of the hard-drinking journalist.
I don't think I created that myth, but I certainly inherited it. It was one of the things that I loved about the idea of the newspaper man in the abstract. I had seen all those newspaper man movies when I was a kid. The idea that you could hold your liquor and type a new lead on a breaking story was one of the things that you wore like a badge of honor. So I suppose during the period that I was drinking, I did help keep the myth going in my own way.
What kind of bars were good to hang out at when you were writing a story, and what could you get from being in a bar when you were looking for leads?
Well, the best bar to hang out in was one that had a typewriter on the premises. And I was not alone in having written stories actually in the basement of the Lion's Head. I think the best newspapermen bars were not inhabited only by newspapermen, but attracted politicians, hustlers of various kinds, actors, ball players, you know, a place that had an overlapping system of the categories that a newspaper is made up of. It wasn't just simply cops in the front of the paper, but it was the ball players in the back of the paper, the actors in the middle of the paper, and the politicians who, if they were not in handcuffs, were certainly at the bar trying to promote themselves into eternity.
But say you were investigating a murder in a Brooklyn neighborhood. Would you try to go to a bar in that neighborhood and hang out for a while, see what you could find out?
Well, almost always. That was the way we operated in those days, because New York at that time, and I'm talking the late 50s, early 60s, through the end of the 60s, really, when things began to change very quickly. New York at that time was a series of hamlets, connected hamlets. And the bar was still a major institution, along with the church and a political club and probably the police precinct. The bars were institutions in which people revealed themselves most nakedly often. So that if you were looking for information about someone in a story, somebody who had been shot and killed, or somebody whose kid had been shot and killed, or a family that had been burned out by a fire, whatever the nature of the story, a good neighborhood bar was probably the best source of information.
When you gave up drinking, could you still go to bars to talk to people about a story you were working on?
Well, I found out I could. I had a fear for a while, and one of the points of this book is that there is not just drinking, but a drinking life that you adhere to. And I thought for a long time that if I gave that up, I would change the nature of my own work. And it turned out, of course, that going to a bar sober, first of all, cuts down the time enormously. You become very aware of the repetition. You suddenly hear the same story told for the fifth time with very little illumination added along the way. But I did and still do go to bars and just shoot the breeze. They know that I don't drink, and those who are still among the living, we cherish our friendships to this day.
Pete Hamill is my guest. His new memoir is called A Drinking Life. How well did you write when you had been drinking?
Well, I never wrote while I was drinking. I had a couple of adventures with it early in my career where I tried to drink and then go into the office and do it, and I could not do it. My fingers would smash between the keys and nothing would come out. Drinking with newspaper men, and I think with a lot of other people too, is often done and most insidiously after work as a kind of reward. You figure, I've really worked at the top of my talent here as hard as I can. Now I'm entitled, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, in a way, the most debilitating part about it, because you continue to say to yourself, I'm not an alcoholic. That guy lying in the gutter with his shoes off, he's an alcoholic. But I work. I get up. I go to the office. I bring home a paycheck, and I feed my kids. But I think there's much more damage done to people's lives, to husbands and wives, to children, to talent, too. To those who work out of a base of talent, by the functioning drunk, the person who can get the work done. And I was very careful. I never drove. I didn't even have a driver's license until after I stopped drinking. And I never drank before I went to work. And that probably prolonged the life longer than I should have.
So you were the kind of drinker who could say, well, I drink, but I never miss a deadline.
Yeah, exactly. I think the most dangerous people, most dangerous myth about all of this is that that you have to hit bottom in order to start on your way up. And the people I knew who hit bottom never recovered. They were gone. They had wet brain, or they were dead. They succumbed to all kinds of things that were not directly alcohol-related, not liver diseases, but they died of pneumonia. They died of bad habits, basically.
So you never bottomed out?
I never bottomed out in the sense that, in the classical sense. I mean, in this book, I wanted to make clear that I was not going to make this worse than it was. It was not about another lost weekend or days of wine and roses in which you got the DTs and you're seeing Richard Nixon in the corner covered with ants. If that happened, it happened while I was awake. But I never got to that point. It's a book about getting to a certain point, realizing you're doing a lot of damage, even though you're having a lot of fun along the way, and pulling back and saying, I'm not going to live that life anymore. And it's the life that I'm talking about. You can't separate with any kind of a problem you have, whether it's drugs or alcohol. You can't separate the dancer from the dance. You can't say, I'm going to solve this problem of alcohol as if it were a pothole disconnected from the rest of things. You have to examine the life that you're leading and the way you got into the habit and into what probably was the destructive part of that habit.
So you never joined AA, never joined support groups. Are you not a support group kind of person?
Not really. I don't dismiss them. I've seen them do enormous good among people that I know very closely. Very close friends of mine have been helped enormously by those groups. But 21 years ago, it wasn't quite as fashionable as it became 10 years ago to go into these 12-step programs. I think when the yuppie generation started getting jammed up with cocaine and other things, that this became a lot more plausible in a way. I come from a family of seven kids. I had a support group. My problem was not the isolation that comes with drinking or bad habits in general. It was dealing with myself. And as a writer, I had certain tools that took the place of that. I kept a journal, for example, after I stopped drinking, just really probing around with the best and toughest parts of my talent into myself for the first time. So that first year, I did a real rigorous examination of myself, the flaws, the holes, the responsibilities for things, not in any sort of masochistic way, but trying to be very clear-eyed and cold-hearted about it.
You're Irish. You grew up in an Irish neighborhood in Brooklyn. Do you think there's any truth in the stereotype of Irish culture as being a drinking culture?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that that Irish culture has been bound together for many centuries by drink. But it's not unique to Ireland. I think if you look at defeated nations, if you look at Poland, if you look at the American Indian, if you look at parts of Mexican life in the Southwest, people who have been defeated often are granted the luxury of destroying themselves by the conquerors. And I think Irish drinking came from the conquest of Ireland. It was not unique to the Irish at the time, but if you have no true power, you're granted certain powers by the occupiers most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is drinking. Another thing is machismo. I think machismo is more prevalent among defeated people than it is among the winners. So that I think the Irish do share something with those other people that is unique to people having lost franchises. It's being able to confront that and say, will we let these people have a permanent victory? That leads to people saying, that's it, I'm not going to do them the favor of becoming a stage Irishman or a stage Pole or a stage Native American.
Right.
I'm going to live my life, not perform it, not according to their script, at least.
Your father was a drinker. Your father was from Ireland, moved to Brooklyn, where you were born. But he drank a lot when you were growing up. Did he ever give it up himself?
No, he never did. Near the end of his life, in the last 5 years of his life, he lived to be 80. In the last years of his life, particularly after his hair started getting gray, which was at the age of 75, God bless him, he had trouble with his heart, and they put a pacemaker in, and the doctor forbade him to either drink or smoke cigarettes. He went into the bleakest depression of his life. And I went to the doctor and said, look, I think the man would rather be dead than to continue to live like this. He is so depressed by all this. And he said, well, tell him he can have 2 drinks and 3 cigarettes. My father, being my father, expanded the franchise to 5 drinks and 8 cigarettes and lived fairly happily until the day he left us. So, no, he did not stop it. He kept drinking, but not at his age, and he had done probably a lot of physical damage. It didn't take much for him to get wrecked. I mean, a few drinks and he would be gone.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist and novelist Pete Hamill. His new memoir is called A Drinking Life. Why don't we take a short break here and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Pete Hamill, the author of a new memoir called A Drinking Life. When you started at the Post in 1960, New York had 7 papers, which is just impossible to imagine now. Cities that have 2 papers are in really good shape nowadays. What was it like to have 7 papers?
It was an absolute feast, and even having the 7 papers, we were mourning the fact that we had already lost 2 or 3. We had lost the Brooklyn Eagle, which I used to deliver as a kid, which had a circulation of 300,000 and was just serving the borough of Brooklyn. That was gone. There was a paper called the Bronx Home News that was gone. I think the city was a better city because we had 7 newspapers. That meant there were 7 different teams of people keeping an eye on the politicians and watching what the cops did and feeding the general sense of debate in the city. For newspaper men, it was an enormous thing because if you didn't have a job, if you didn't like the job you had at the New York Journal American, you could go down the street and go to work for the Post. Somebody would always hire a good craftsman. So there was a kind of security in the work that is missing now for a lot of people. But more than anything else, it was that you had 7 distinct points of view on almost everything in the city that simply has not been replaced by television.
When you started working at the Post, do you think that the newspaper had a different place in its readers' lives than newspapers have in the lives of readers today?
Oh, I think that's, I think lamentably that's true. Because television, although it was strong in 1960 and had been strong for most of a decade, television had not become the all-ruling version of information and entertainment that it's now become. The respect, almost worship, of the printed word that came from the immigrants. For example, if you think that the Daily Forward, which is a Yiddish daily, once had a circulation of 250,000, and that its children were reading the New York Post, the children of those readers were reading the New York Post, you know that you were dealing with generations of people who knew that the words would set them free. They worshipped newspapers. Columnists were the biggest stars in New York, not television people. Television people read news. It was an enormous, amazing period to be young and be alive in a city like New York.
It's funny, when you started at the Post in 1960, some people at the paper were afraid that the Post wouldn't live to see the end of the year. Of course, that's a tradition that's kept on. And last year, during the New York Post ownership wars, you were named editor-in-chief to save the paper. Then you were immediately fired by another publisher who bought the paper.
And then reinstated.
Yeah, now, after you were fired, though, you came in anyways to run the paper. Well, how did you make the decision to come in spite of the fact that you were fired?
Oh, it wasn't even a contest. You know, the guys that were running it as interim editors called me and said, "We got to have you here." And I said, "I'll be there." The reason was that the newspaper, that particular newspaper, had given me my life. If I had not been hired by Jimmy Wexler in the summer of 1960, I don't know what I'd be today. I have no idea. The paper gave me the way into the world that I had been searching desperately for as a kid since I was probably 8 or 9 years old, to go out into the world and embrace it and see it and ratify it and have it ratify me. And that newspaper, if there was anything physically or intellectually or emotionally that I could do to keep that newspaper alive, I was going to do it. If it meant standing in the doorway and fighting the cops, I was ready to do it.
So what did you have to do?
Well, we did it with, I think, enormous humor and a lot of style and a lot of fun and a sense of camaraderie. We just continued to put out the newspaper. It gave us enough time to begin the process of trying to find somebody who would buy the newspaper and keep it open. And we did that. It was finally Rupert Murdoch who came back through a series of legal and other moves to take over the paper again. And although there are some people not happy with what Murdoch has done, including some of the people who fought to keep it alive, it is alive, and I think if an institution is alive, it's capable of any number of transformations. This newspaper, I think, will be around in the 21st century.
How have you seen the role of the owner of a newspaper change over the years?
Well, I was lucky because Dorothy Schiff had a very personal involvement in running the Post when I was a kid. She would wander into the city room. She didn't know who the hell anybody was or what they did, but I think she did feel a very personal connection to that newspaper. And as a woman owner of a paper, she was very good at making certain that the staff had a whole lot of women on it, that people had opportunities. That blacks, for example, were given chances to work there. The first black reporter in a mainstream paper started at that newspaper. I think the growth of the large abstract corporation as owners of newspapers, although it provides a certain amount of security, I suppose, to those institutions, also separates the staff from a sense of embrace and loyalty and ownership based on talent, you know, where you could say, "This is my newspaper." When you said, "This is my newspaper," you didn't mean that you owned it. It meant that you had a piece of the franchise. You had paid some rent with the time of your life on that newspaper. I don't think that that's quite the same. I hope I'm wrong. Because there's nothing quite like having that sense of walking out of school or coming out of whatever life you had into a newspaper and saying, "Man or woman, this is my newspaper." I hope that the younger people feel that, although the reports I get make me apprehensive about it.
You started off as a comic artist before you became a journalist. And you write about a couple of experiences when you were young, like you were sketching your girlfriend, and when she saw the sketch, she got really angry, and she thought, "You must think I'm ugly," because she didn't like the way you looked, and the way she looked. And then you sketched somebody else, and they were really angry because they thought, "Do I look like that? Is my nose that big?"
Right.
Did that teach you a lesson about what happens when you record your version of the truth?
Yes. In a word, yes. I mean, I learned what I later learned reading art history, why court painters were often put in the joint by the various kings for, you know, Velasquez painting all the idiot children of the king of Spain probably was at the risk of his life. But I think it is a metaphor in an odd way for what you're trying to do. I think anybody, and I don't pretend to compare myself to artists, to great artists like that, but I think if you tell the truth, you're sometimes going to make people unhappy. But you have to be as ruthless with yourself as you are with them if you're going to be any good.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Terry Gross speaking with journalist Pete Hamill. His new memoir is called A Drinking Life. I'm Chris Spurgeon, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. Is racial identity just a matter of skin color? We'll talk with Shirley Taylor Hazlett, a black woman whose skin is as light as many whites. She thinks of herself as black, but many of her light-skinned relatives thought they'd have a better chance in life if they passed for white, and that's just what they did. Hazlett's search for these relatives is the subject of her new memoir. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Silent Woman by Janet Malcolm. The book, which first appeared as an essay in The New Yorker, is a reflection on the various attempts by biographers to chronicle the life of the late poet Sylvia Plath. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A Palestinian woman has been shot and killed by a Jewish settler in the West Bank town of El Jeeb. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Military sources say Palestinians threw stones at an Israeli commercial truck as it was passing through the town of El Jeeb near Ramallah. The truck's driver began shooting at the stone throwers. Some of the bullets went through the front door of a village house, killing a 19-year-old woman inside. Israel Radio reported the woman was 8 months pregnant. Israeli police arrested the truck driver, and the Ramallah area has been declared a closed military zone. There's been an increase in stoning incidents since the occupied territories were sealed off last week. Today's incident has further angered Palestinians, who were already upset at the closure of the territories and the announcement that Palestinian self-rule in Gaza and Jericho, originally scheduled to begin tomorrow, has been delayed. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
U.S. Marines are leaving Burundi after helping Westerners get out of neighboring Rwanda. A Marine commander says about 250 Americans lived in Rwanda. Most of them were aid workers and missionaries. He says all who wanted to leave were able to. One British citizen who's owned a tea factory in Rwanda for more than 25 years says he got out with just a small suitcase. Tony Wood says he's never seen violence like this before. Japanese Foreign Minister Tsutomu Hata denies the country's ruling coalition is going to collapse. Senior coalition members have been trying to choose a new prime minister now that Premier Morihiro Hosokawa has quit. The BBC's David Powers reports from Tokyo.
Tsutomu Hata told a news conference it's true that various emotions have become entangled, but if we go back to the starting point of why we established the coalition, I think we can restore it. In spite of his protestations, Mr. Hata and several of his colleagues didn't bother to turn up at the latest meeting called to select a new prime minister. Instead of talking about candidates and policies, the leaders of the coalition are wrangling about protocol and exactly who should attend the meetings. But none of this can hide the fact that the coalition has now split into two camps. A more conservative group, represented by Mr. Hata's Japan Renewal Party and two other parties, and a more left-wing group led by the socialists. Neither group wants to be held responsible for the collapse of the coalition, which, in spite of Mr. Hosokawa's resignation, still enjoys majority public support.
David Powers reporting. The government says inflation at the producer level rose slightly in March. The Labor Department says the producer price index was up 0.2%. Volatile energy costs were unchanged. Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials fell more than 7 points to end the day at 3,681. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The General Accounting Office says the Pentagon is overpaying some of its contractors. The GAO says some contractors have been giving back money they didn't ask for and weren't entitled to, but got anyway. The GAO says during the first 9 months of fiscal 1993, military contractors sent back nearly $1.5 billion in overpayments. Ohio Senator John Glenn says in most cases the mistake turned up because the recipients found them, not because of good bookkeeping by the Pentagon. Glenn wants to know how much the government may be owed from contractors who have not returned overpayments. Flooding along the Mississippi River and its tributaries is forcing some people from their homes. Victims of last year's Midwest floods are increasingly worried. Lester Graham of member station KWMU reports.
Both the Mississippi and Missouri rivers are above flood stage, but not significantly. It's the smaller rivers that are causing the problems. The Merrimack at Eureka, Missouri, near St. Louis, is 22 feet above flood stage and expected to crest to higher than 30 feet above flood stage by Thursday. A meteorologist at Parks College of St. Louis University, Ben Abel, says the smaller rivers have been quick to rise, but will be just as quick to fall.
The people that live along that stream, they're used to flooding. They're used to a lot of flooding. But once you start getting water this high, going to displace a lot of people over the next 2-3 days. They're just not going to be gone that long.
The Mississippi at St. Louis is expected to crest at 9 feet above flood stage in 2 or 3 days, but downstream, where the Mississippi meets the Ohio, flooding will be worse. For National Public Radio, I'm Lester Graham in St. Louis.
There's gunfire in Garajda, Bosnia. The UN military commander there says he's heard some sporadic shooting around the town. But General Michael Rowe says Muslim defenders are shooting, not the Bosnian Serbs. The Muslims could be trying to provoke the Serbs to attack. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're featuring a recent interview Terry did with writer Shirley Taylor Hazelip. Hazelip is black, but she says many people would never know it. Her skin is as light as that of the average white person. But she also says her psyche, soul, and sensibility are black. That wasn't the case with most of the relatives on her mother's side of the family. They preferred to pass for white. To do so, they had to cut themselves off from their extended family. Hazelip's new memoir, The Sweeter the Juice, is about how and why she tracked down the part of her family that disappeared into the white world. Haslip's mother, Margaret, was brought up by darker-skinned relatives. Margaret had been abandoned by her own family at the age of 4, soon after her mother died. Her father was an alcoholic who didn't want the responsibility of raising a child. Neither did the older children in the family. Terry Gross asked Shirley Taylor Haslip why it was so important for her to track down the members of her mother's family who passed for white.
I wanted to do something very special for my mother for her 80th birthday, and their absence had haunted me as it had haunted her all of her life, and I wanted to give her a sense of closure and some sense of what had happened in her family and why they had disappeared, because we knew nothing, and I felt it was important for her, important for me, and important for my children to know something about the other side of our family.
You say that that their disappearance haunted you. What haunted you about it?
Well, I had on one side a very full, robust clan of wonderful black, dark-skinned people. And on the other side, there was nothing. I had no way to compare who I looked like, what I might have inherited from them, and what genes might have been transmitted to me. And I knew that it was something that was very sorrowful for my mother. And I think I probably absorbed some of her sorrow at a very early age.
Did you always know that your mother's family passed for white?
I knew from early on, but I understood it at different levels according to how old I was. I knew that she had a father, and he was my grandfather, and I knew he was living. And she just said he was being a white man. And when I first heard that, I didn't quite understand what it meant. And I understood it as I grew older. But I knew the family had all left the race, so to speak.
Were you able to find out exactly why the members of your mother's family wanted to live as white people?
No, the problem is all of them except my mother's sister are dead. So a lot of it is speculation based on what happened during that time period. It was a depression, and racism was rampant. They were living between two races. And I'm fairly certain they made the choice for economic and social reasons, believing that the privilege of white skin would take them out of the problems of being black in America at that time.
Now, it's interesting, your father's side of the family is this really prominent African-American family. And, you know, although so many people on your mother's side passed as white, on your father's side, your father was a pastor. He formed the local chapter of the NAACP. He headed that chapter for 35 years. He integrated the local Y. He was a prosperous man. He owned property from Washington to Maine. And as you say, your father wanted his family to be, quote, exemplary Negroes.
Right. Well, of course, that, you know, was the language of the time. But his father, too, had been a prominent man, and that's how he was raised, and he was raised to be a leader, and he wanted his children to exercise leadership roles and to help galvanize and change the community. So we were brought up to see ourselves as change agents.
So it must have particularly mystified you why, while you were living in this family that was so proud of being black and so at the forefront of community work, to on the other hand have this part of the family that just left
yes,
the race.
Yes, that's exactly right. But you see, they lived in different places and under different circumstances.
Mm-hmm,
and
my
father's family was just fortunate enough and worked hard enough to be able to become privileged and do well. And so that it sort of turns American stereotypes on their head, because the family that chose to be white, thinking it would get the advantage that whiteness brings in this country, did not exactly fulfill those dreams. Whereas the black family, which had to struggle against all of the tides of racism in the country, did fairly well.
My guest is Shirley Taylor Haslip. Her new memoir is called The Sweeter the Juice, a family memoir in black and white. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Shirley Taylor Haslip. So when you decided that you wanted to track down your surviving aunt who passed as white, you hired a private detective. And the private detective found her in Anaheim.
Anaheim, California. And I said, how perfect, the land of Disney World.
Yeah.
But you see, I didn't know who existed. I mean, I didn't know whether the aunt was still living or the uncles or the cousins. But we found that she was still living.
Mm-hmm.
And then she became the Rosetta Stone, so to speak, to opening the doors and discovering the rest of the family, because she, on her side, and my mother's white side, she knew where they were and she had stayed in touch with them.
So once you found out her address, you were living in Los Angeles.
That's right.
You showed up at her door.
Right, unannounced.
Unannounced, with a bouquet of flowers.
Right.
And what did you say to her?
Well, as you can imagine, I was in turmoil because I had heard about this woman all of my life. I didn't know what she looked like. And I had mixed feelings of anger and fright. I thought perhaps I would be rejected as my mother had been. And I was terribly curious. So at the moment I arrived, I rang the bell. And out of the gloom comes a little woman who looked like my mother. And that startled me. I don't know what I expected her to look like, but I'd never seen anybody who looked like my mother. And she smiled at me and she said, who would you like? I said, I have flowers for Mrs. Kramer. And she said, I'm Mrs. Kramer. Who are the flowers from? And at that point, my throat almost closed up. But I said, they're from your sister Margaret and me, your niece Shirley. She took the flowers, and a look went across her face that I couldn't read because I didn't know her. But then she composed herself, and she said, well, come in. And from that point, we began a dialogue. And I had to be very gentle and delicate with her because she was nearing 90. And here I was, a visible evidence of a past that she had repressed or rejected or denied or hid or whatever.
Has she been able to tell friends that she's from a black family?
I don't think she's told any friends yet. It was very difficult for her to tell her own family.
Her family didn't know.
No, see, she all of the siblings married white, and they never told the people they married they had black heritage. And then they had children, and the children did not know. So she had one daughter, whom I never met because the daughter died, unfortunately. But the daughter then had three children, and I knew those three children were living near her in Anaheim. And she, over the course of the year, was not able to tell them. And I didn't want to tell them. I didn't think it was my place. But ultimately, I was in contact with one after she told me he was coming east to look for information about his family.
In your book, you write that your aunt could not give up being white. And you say that she didn't exactly pass for white. She became white.
Yes, I deliberately chose that word because I want the reader to think about that. If you live white, you marry white, you go to church white, you assume a white point of view, are you not white? And what does being white or what does being black mean? No one in her world knew she was not white. So, and I carefully researched the laws now of the country. There's nothing that legally defines blackness anymore since 1983, the last law was struck down. So I suggest that, race in many cases can indeed simply be a matter of context or self-definition. And in her case, and in the case of literally hundreds of thousands of other black Americans who have passed over, they have become white.
You've obviously become very interested in your whole family.
Yes.
Your mother's side, your father's side, including the part of your family that passed for white and the part of your family that was white.
Right.
How has it changed your sense of yourself to find out as much as you have?
I think it's added, and I think it's made me much more tolerant. I always thought of myself as a tolerant person anyway, but I had only defined myself as an African-American, or when it was more fashionable, as black, or as a Negro, or as colored. We went through all of that. But now, if someone said to me, well, what are you? I would say, socially, I am a black person, but I have roots in many gardens. In this country, many ethnic people marry other ethnic people. And when you say to them, what's your nationality, they might say, I'm Russian and Czechoslovakian, or I'm Italian and Irish. So why shouldn't other people be able to say they're this and they're that? Why should they be forced only into one category?
It's interesting what you said, how you described yourself as socially a black person.
Yes. Well, I think there is a black psyche, and I believe there is a white psyche based on the experiences that we have. And blacks generally, I think, have a double consciousness because we have to go through life in two worlds. But you could go into a store, perhaps, and not worry about whether someone would cash your check or whether somebody would follow you around if you have light skin or if you're a white person. Whereas a black person is always concerned about the possibility of rejection or negative encounters, and that becomes part of our psyche. We have these antennae out, not that we're looking for trouble or confrontation, but we know that the potential for danger or harassment or rejection is just there. And so that becomes a permanent part of our psyche. It becomes part of that well of rage that I mentioned and that so many other authors have mentioned that most black people walk around with.
So did you ever have contempt, and do you have any contempt now for people who were from black families but were light and lived as white people?
No, I would say my feeling was more sorrow. And not at them, but at the conditions of the country which forced them to make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be judgmental about what they decided to do because they did it for their own reasons, to survive or to have a better life. It's not a choice that I would have agreed with. And certainly it caused great sorrow in our family. But my sorrow has more to do with, or contempt has to do with, racism in the country and the need for people to escape who they are, to become someone else, to be comfortable.
This research started in part as a birthday gift to your mother for her 80th birthday. You wanted to, if you could, reunite her with a member of the family that had disappeared. And so you managed to do that. What was your mother's reaction? Was she excited?
She was excited. She was sad. She was angry. She thought about all that old hurt. You know, all those old feelings resurfaced again. But I think most of all, the overriding feeling was, I'm finally going to meet my sister. This little girl I dreamed about, this little girl I used to walk down the streets of Washington to see, this little girl I used to cut out pictures of in magazines and say, I wonder if my sister looks like that. And so she realized a lifelong dream. And you see, she had three daughters and a son, and we were all close. And she often said, gee, I really wished I could have been close to my sister like my children are close to each other. So for her, it was the realization of a dream. Now, it wasn't the most perfect dream because, you know, so much time had passed, and really they were strangers and they had lived different lives. And yet, family transcended race. She found her sister.
Were you there when your mother and her sister met?
Oh, yes, yes, because I had been meeting with my aunt for the year, and so she knew me and she felt comfortable with me, and I knew that I couldn't thrust my mother onto her without some kind of a physical nurturance. And so I was there, but I tried to stay in the background, and I was very touched and very moved by what I saw.
What did they talk about?
Well, they both love cats, and so the cat in the house the cat in the house broke the ice, and they both have daughters named Patricia. Isn't that amazing? And they both have grandsons named Jeffrey. So they talked about their cats and their daughter and their grandchildren. You know, the things that sisters talk about.
But they didn't talk about race.
Oh, no, 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 no. You see, one of the wonderful things we found out was that when the family dissolved and when the sister left, she was only a little girl, too. So when my mother asked her, well, you know, do you know why our father left and why the family broke up? She said something that was very poignant. And she said, well, I don't know, because I was just a little girl, too.
So does your aunt think of herself as having been brought up white as opposed to having made the decision to pass?
I think that's an interesting question, and I don't know whether she could articulate that. I think she has repressed a lot of her memories, and I think she became white both on a conscious and an unconscious level.
But, I mean, she wasn't unaware, was she, of the fact that she's from a black family?
No, she wasn't.
A predominantly black family.
No, she wasn't unaware of it, but what I'm saying is I think she submerged it.
I think
she repressed.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Terry Gross spoke with Shirley Taylor Hayslip earlier this year. Her new book is called The Sweeter the Juice, a family memoir in black and white. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer joins us from National Public Radio with a preview of what's coming up in All Things Considered. And Linda, I understand George Mitchell will not be on the Supreme Court.
The senator from Maine has taken his name out of the running. He said he told the president last night what his reasons were. The president told him that it was his if he wanted it, and he said he did not. We'll be talking to Nina Totenberg also about some of the other people who may now make it onto the president's shortlist for the court. We have a very chilling conversation with a reporter who is in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, about what is happening there. We'll also take a look at what is happening to the gorillas in the mist, the mountain gorillas of Rwanda.
Okay, thanks, Linda. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the big literary events of last summer was the publication of Janet Malcolm's long essay in the New Yorker magazine, titled The Silent Woman. In it, Malcolm reflected on various biographers' attempts to chronicle the life of poet Sylvia Plath. The Silent Woman has just been published as a book, and critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
As luck would have it, my poetry classes just finished studying some Sylvia Plath poems, which they got pretty angry about. The women objected to Plath's confession in her poem Daddy, that every woman adores a fascist. While the guys resented the last line of Lady Lazarus, where Plath brags, I eat men like air. Actually, I was relieved my students discussed Plath's poetry at all, because mostly they just want to talk about her suicide, her ghastly decision to stick her head inside an oven one February morning in 1962. What made her do it? Students always ask. I usually mumble something about Plath being depressed over her husband, the poet Ted Hughes, having an affair. And the minute I open my mouth, I see the caricatures calcifying in my students' heads. Ted Hughes, the abusive lout. Sylvia Plath, his pathetic victim. How can any of us ever know the complicated truth of each other's lives? That's the key question Janet Malcolm mulls over throughout The Silent Woman. Malcolm knows Plath is a great subject for any meditation on biography because each Plath biography is so dramatically different. There's Plath, the naive American girl, Plath, the dutiful daughter, and Plath, the egomaniacal poetic genius. And that's just for starters. Malcolm also finds the Plath biographies fascinating because through them, she continues to torment her surviving relatives, particularly Ted Hughes. For years, Hughes has refused to speak about his marriage to Plath. If she's been silenced by death, he's been silenced by anger at various biographical distortions. But though Malcolm is very sympathetic to Hughes, she's also hip to the self-serving dual role he plays, trying his damnedest to disentangle himself from the Plath legend while also vigorously tending its flame. Like other Malcolm books, The Silent Woman has become very controversial. Malcolm has been slammed by some reviewers for faulting the efforts of other nonfiction writers while neglecting to fess up to her own failures to write the truth. In a much-publicized legal case, a jury found her guilty of tampering with some of the direct quotes she attributed to renegade Freud scholar Jeffrey Mason and thus libeling him. But the jury couldn't agree on damages, so the case is being tried again. But whatever sins Malcolm is guilty of, dull-wittedness is not one of them. The Silent Woman conjures up more lightning-bolt insights into the nature of biography than most works of critical theory I know. Here, for example, Malcolm crystallizes a crucial difference between nonfiction and fiction. In a work of nonfiction, she says, we almost never know the truth of what happened. The ideal of unmediated reporting is regularly achieved only in fiction, where the writer faithfully reports on what is going on in his imagination. What's also really striking about The Silent Woman as a work of criticism is that it has atmosphere, the kind of brooding atmosphere you'd find in an Agatha Christie mystery. Malcolm treks through shabby university clubrooms and crooked English cottages in search of people who might solve the riddle of Plath's identity. In the last few pages of her book, Malcolm enters a house that becomes, in her description, the most astonishing and sinister image for the creative mind I've ever encountered. By the time you escape from that house with Malcolm, you're charged with a deep, schizophrenic awareness of why biography is both impossible and irresistible.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Silent Woman by Janet Malcolm. All of us here at Fresh Air want to extend our most joyful congratulations to our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz for winning the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism for his writings in the Boston Phoenix. We've always felt proud to have Lloyd as part of the Fresh Air family, and we're so pleased he's been honored. For Terry Gross, I'm Chris Spurgeon.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Richard Thompson first became known as a member of the folk rock band Fairport Convention. His own records feature his extraordinary guitar playing, songwriting, and singing. On the next Fresh Air, a concert and an interview with Richard Thompson. I'm Chris Spurgeon. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.